Well, good evening, everyone. As Thomas put it, it's time for class.
Knows that word.
It's good to be with you tonight. I hope you were able to grab a copy of the questions for tonight's class. It's, I guess, if you're counting lessons, it's less than 19. If you're counting class periods, it's 48. Maybe not 48, maybe more like 20. But anyway, Genesis chapter 18 is where we find ourselves this evening in our Genesis study. Look forward to discussing that with you and hearing some of your thoughts about a lot of the things that go on here in this particular section. Just as I'm thinking about it, I wanted to remind you, if you ever lose your copy of the questions or want one of the old copies or just something happens and you need it, if you go to our website, you look up, I think it's under resources, and then it's Bible class materials. As I complete the question sections, they're always uploaded that same day to the website, so you can download it, print it if you want to. Or if you're on your mobile device and it supports Word, you can actually pull it up on there and look at it. Also, on the website under the calendar, I've started adding, there's a recurring date for just Wednesday night Bible study in general, and it's always Wednesday at 7. But I've started making an individual one for each Wednesday with what section we're on. So just in case I don't remember where we are, I can't get to my question, you can look at that calendar, click on the day, it'll tell you precisely where we ought to be. And so tonight we're in Genesis chapter 18. Okay, a fascinating account, a wonderful account. One of my very favorite jokes from Genesis comes from here, so it's always a favorite text of mine. Genesis 18 and verse 1. The Lord appears to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre, or by the terebinths, or however your translation puts that. Essentially, he's near a bunch of trees there in Mamre, as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. We've heard the oaks of Mamre a couple of times before. Chapter 13 and verse 18 is reference to him having been there. Also, chapter 15 and verse 13. Pretty much Abraham's home base of operations for the most part in Canaan when he wasn't traveling from place to place. What happens here? He lifted up his eyes and what does he see? Okay, three men approach Abraham. And of course, this is not going to do. Three men approach Abraham. Now my first question in the questions for tonight was, by some estimations, kind of a sticky one. Who are those three men? Or at least give a good argument for who the three men are. Okay, so one popular explanation is they're all just, you know, three angels. Okay, I wouldn't disagree wholeheartedly. I do think there's some evidence in the text that specifies one of them a little more carefully than the other two. What's that? Not in this case. Lot comes up in chapter 19. Because remember, the angels go down to Sodom to see if it's as bad as they think it is, or that's a way of our putting it, to see if it is as evil as has been reported, and Lot's there with them. Okay, he's in Sodom and they meet him there. So certainly not Lot, one of these individuals. That's the thing in the text that keeps standing out to me and why I might make an argument that this is the Lord and two angels. Now, one thing I have to make real clear. This isn't the Lord. I mean, this isn't the complete glory version of God. Why not? Yeah, no man shall see God and live. That's a big principle in Scripture. Okay, God told Moses, "You can't see me. I'll let you see the back part of me, as He did on Sinai, but no man can see me and live." So whatever this is, it's a theophany. It's some sort of vision of God. God has made Himself visible or manifest in some version, in some way that Abraham's able to tolerate. The text tells us it's three men. Some evidence that it's the Lord and two angels. If you look at chapter 18 and in verse 10, after the three men are seated to eat, which we're going to get into the meal in just a second, who speaks? Yeah, the Lord said, "I will surely, you know, do this or that." And it is all capital letters. So that's it's the same all caps as you see in other places in Genesis. It's the name God uses for himself, the covenant name, Yahweh. And Yahweh said to him, okay? And then verse 14, there's another reference to that. If you look at chapter 18 and verse 22, okay, after the meal and after this sort of monologue that is recorded there, the two angels go down to Sodom, and who's left? Verse 22. Abraham stood before the Lord. Okay, so maybe a little bit more evidence as to who this is, or at least what he sees and who that represents. Verse 33, the same thing happens. The Lord goes his way after speaking with Abraham. So just something to think about. Something to sort of chew on. Yes, sir.
You also, I thought since Abraham kept asking him 50 moved to 45 and 40 to 30 down to 10, could anybody but the Lord grant that?
That's a fair point.
Unless it was a representative of the Lord that knew ahead of time.
And sometimes there is that whoever it is speaks on behalf of God. So I wouldn't. You know, I would never declare from the pulpit that if you think differently, you know, I think you're condemned. I would never say any. I mean, that's just generally a good rule. But I wouldn't stand up and make my stand on this case. But there's evidence in the text that maybe suggests one of the angels is different from the other two. Yes, sir. Personal, yeah. Even and to that point, later on in chapter 19, they make reference that the Lord sent us to destroy it. You know, yeah. That's a good point, though. Yeah, there's that reference to two angels, and they're not. It doesn't say three angels came to Abraham in the earlier part. So some evidence to that. Reed, I saw you had a hand up. There is a temptation to take, oh, there's three of them, and go to the most famous example of three, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. That's tempting, I will admit. Even when I studied this, I thought, is there any meat on that? You know, is there anything possible there? And there's none that I could find. If there's good evidence to it, I'd be glad to hear it. But anyway, okay, who they are is not something the text spends a great deal of time on. What it does spend time on is what happens when they meet Abraham and what he goes about doing. He sees these three men, all of a sudden they're standing in front of him. What does Abraham do? Okay, stop and have a bite to eat. Okay, sit a spell, have a bite. Now, what's interesting here is how active Abraham is. Okay, this sort of, you get this idea there's a flurry of activity. Okay. How does Abraham go to them in the first place? Verse 2. He ran to them. How old is Abraham? All right, fellas. No excuses. The man Abraham ran. Okay? He's got a lot on the ball. He can run to them. Falls on his face. Offers them. I love this in verse 3. If there's a biblical proof for understatement, all right, it's found in 18 and verse 4. Let a little water be brought. And wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree while I bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves and after that you may pass on. And then he goes quickly and accumulates an overwhelming amount of food. I mean, not water and a piece of bread. Okay, have you looked into how much food he made for them, or rather Sarah and he made for them? It's huge, okay? For me to do this for you would be a small thing, but then he goes and he does absolutely as much as he can. In verse 6, he goes quickly, okay, to Sarah, and he tells her, quick, make, you know, 3 seahs, or however that's pronounced, of fine flour. He runs to the herd. The calf is prepared quickly. It stood by them. He is an active, active person. Okay, the amount of flour works out to somewhere around 21 quarts. Which if you're an outdoor, if you know anything about buckets, it's a rounded over 5-gallon bucket. Okay, of flour. To then make it into cakes and then bake it. And then you've got the calf and then you've got the curds and the milk. All of these things. Okay. There is a good point we need to make here that gets repeated further along in the biblical story. When God participates in a meal with His people, what does that mean? Because it happens again a few more times. When God participates in a meal, what's that? They're in fellowship with one another. And it's, well, almost without exception, it's a sign that there's peace and that there's covenant between them. Okay, this is something you do with someone you have a relationship with. Okay. Yeah, like a communion with them. Can you think of any meals that go on today that represents that same sort of bond of fellowship? Yeah. It's a sign of there's a bond and that there's a relationship with each other. Abraham's going to do this again in chapter 26. Okay, Abraham, we're going to study about this hopefully soon, but Abraham is going to meet with Abimelech and they're going to form a covenant with each other. Okay, and in verse 30, they make a feast and they eat together. Okay, so Abraham does this again later, even in his story. After the covenant's ratified with the people of Israel, this is Exodus chapter 24. And Moses and Aaron and the elders of Israel, remember they go up Mount Sinai, and what do? It says they sat down and they ate and drank before the Lord. Okay. It's this idea, we formed this covenant, so now we're going to have this relationship. Can you think about anyone else who made meat and unleavened cakes and presented them to an angel under a tree? Not David, one of the judges. It was the one who kept asking for reassurances. Gideon does this a version of this same thing. Okay, presents these things to the angel. So it happens a few more times. It's good to notice this, that we have God and we have man in this relationship with each other, eating with one another. There's also a reference in the New Testament to events like this one. Hebrews 13 and in verse 2, the Hebrew writer gives us some instructions here. How are we to do or to treat strangers? Yeah, that's the phrase specifically, right? Some have entertained angels unawares, right? Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. That verse could be in reference to this event. It could be in reference to Lot. Chapter 19, Lot does the same thing for total strangers. It happens again with Samson's parents, okay, Manoah and his wife. They entertain an angel, and they actually make the comment afterwards, we didn't know who it was, you know, that we entertained. So something to keep in mind, that we have application even for us. It would have applied to Israel, it would have also applied to us. Right. Could be. I've wondered about that. It could be miraculous. True. I had one person suggest to me, well, maybe he was asleep. I don't know. He's an old man. Might have been asleep. I don't know. Could have been miraculous. Could have been completely normal. I don't know. Okay, the text doesn't indicate that to us. But here's the interesting part. Who's the conversation about in the first 15 verses? Sarah, specifically. Okay, they don't lead off with, you are going to have a child. They ask first, where is Sarah, your wife? Where is she? She's in the tent. Okay, this is biblical proof that both Abraham and Sarah were hard to live with. When the angel comes to them, Abraham's in tents. Sarah's in tents. It's working. It's working. I had to. They were both in tents when they were found by the angel. Okay, so.
You know they couldn't have been thinking of an angel of being in heaven, because I'm sure that Abraham did not tell everybody that his name was Abraham, and Sarah.
True. That is actually a good point. They didn't know her by her original name. They called her by her given name from God. So that is a good point. I'd never noticed that before. The focus is definitely on Sarah. Okay, it actually begins the section from say 9 down to 15. It begins and ends with something said to Sarah, or something said in reference to Sarah. It begins with, where's Sarah, your wife? It finishes with, no, you did laugh. Okay, it's speaking directly to her. There are some parallels between this and what we see in chapter 17. Chapter 17, it's really focused on Abraham. God's speaking to Abraham saying, here's the blessings you're going to have. You're going to conceive. You're going to call his name Isaac. But there are some similarities. In both cases, God makes an incredible promise to both of them. Okay, 17 and 16, he promises that a child would come from Sarah. That's an incredible promise. Chapter 18 and verse 10. I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. Both cases, something incredible, really, really impossible thing God has promised. How do they both react? They both laugh to themselves, which I find fascinating. When Abram's told this, he laughs to himself. Again, I don't think it's mockery. I think it's incredulous. It's how on earth is this possible? Sarah makes the same laugh within herself, and for the same reason. Okay, she sees that she's old, and Abraham's old, and the time for this thing has passed. Both of them notice this. In both cases, Abraham and Sarah both offer the excuse for why it shouldn't be possible. In 17 and 17, Abraham says, shall a child be born to a man 100 years old? And then in chapter 18, Sarah makes a different version of the same objection. The way of women had departed from her. Okay, is she going to have this pleasure? What did God say to both of them afterwards? Well, even more specifically, what's the first word out of God's mouth in both cases? No. He says no to both of them specifically, right? Abraham raises this objection about Ishmael, and God says no. But Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son. Okay, Sarah denies that she laughed, and then God says, no, you did. Okay, in both cases, you have sort of, so there's some indications we can almost see these as parallel. They have a lot of similarities between the two. God demonstrates his overwhelming knowledge here. One, the point Bill made, he called Sarah by her God-given name, not her original name, which is something I didn't notice. What else in the text demonstrates his power and his knowledge? All right, he makes this promise. Okay, I'm going to return here next year, and your very old wife, and you are going to have a son. Okay, you're going to have a son. All right. So specific which gender? All right, that's an important thing to know. Blake, did you have something? The Lord knew that she had laughed within herself and said so. Okay. And she denies it, and he goes, No, you did. Okay. God quotes her directly for something she said. It doesn't say that she came out of the tent and came and sat down. She stayed in the tent. All these things happened, and the Lord called her out directly. You ever wonder this, not wonder, but maybe this gives us some reason for verse 15. Why did Sarah deny that she laughed? afraid. Why would she be afraid? Something here is not right. Or this isn't just some ordinary person. Okay. It would have terrified any one of us. Okay. Yeah. That would get your attention real fast. So she does deny it. I think she denies. She definitely says she denies it out of fear. Okay, and out of this trying to reckon with who this is that's talking to her. Sarah has a dishonest response because of fear. Has Abraham done that in our story? Answered dishonestly because of fear? She's my sister. Because she was afraid. It happens in chapter 12. It happens again in chapter 20. When he goes to, and he was afraid of the men where Abimelech is king. Happens again. Too many parallels to ignore. There's this quote here in chapter 17. What do you think it's centered around? Is anything too hard for the Lord? Well, we already did that one. Nope, we'll go back. Is anything too hard for the Lord? What are your thoughts on that phrase in particular? The answer is clearly no. Okay, he doesn't wait around for an answer. Yeah. Rhetorical questions are almost always answered in the opposite in the way they're stated. Is anything too hard for the Lord? No. Okay, is the obvious answer. One author put it this way, and I really appreciated this. He said, "The Lord chose to do the impossible because the promised seed was to be known as the Lord's provision." Or in other words, an impossible situation was chosen to prove that it had to be God. Okay, that it wasn't just happenstance, or it wasn't just a freak accident of nature that two people of this age had a child. It had to come from God. Okay, there are some other references to this idea of something being hard or something being difficult for the Lord. And I find them fascinating. One of them is in Psalm 139 and verse 6. This is just another reference to the same word that's used there in Genesis 18. The writer, David here, speaking of himself, says, "To such knowledge is too wonderful for me." That word wonderful is the same one translated hard over in Genesis 18. David's saying, listen, these things, they're just beyond me. They're above me. I can't attain to them. But when it comes to God, that concept doesn't exist. That there's something he can't attain to, or he can't think about, or he can't work on. Okay, and there are other good ones. It's stressing his infinite knowledge, which is a good thing always to notice. It's important that we don't leave Sarah in chapter 18 and just say, oh, well, that's the end for poor Sarah. Poor, doubting, faithless Sarah. We do that with Thomas in the New Testament, right? The only thing we remember Thomas for is the thing he does right after the resurrection. And we forget completely that before the resurrection, Thomas is as ready to die as Peter is. Okay. So we want to make sure we don't leave Sarah here on a bad note. Does Sarah come to faith? Or is this the end of the story? Well, sure. Okay. How do we know that? Well, she had the child, okay, so we have just proof in that way. Is there anywhere else in the text that shows us that Sarah herself came to faith? And that may be, that one I'm not sure, that you may be true, I just don't know that for certain. Sarah gets a place in Hebrews chapter 11. You guys realize that? I didn't know. It was news to me, which was incredible. Abraham's mentioned twice in Hebrews chapter 11. But Sarah herself is mentioned in chapter 11 and in verse 11. It says of her, it says, "By faith Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised." That's an incredible reference to her faith. So yes, she does have her doubting moment. She lies to the Lord out of fear, but she goes past that. Okay? and reaches that place where she's going to have faith. Yes, sir. It's important to notice that both Abraham and Sarah struggled really, really mightily with this. And they both have their moments of doubt, and they both laugh, and they both are corrected by the Lord, but they both eventually reach faith. It's a good thing for all of us to remember, okay? Mm-hmm. Here's an example of the holy women, or one of the godly women. It's excellent. Okay. What should Israel learn from the account? This is written to Israel in the wilderness. What should they take away from it for themselves? Okay. Another sort of layering on of nothing's impossible for God. Okay. And when he says it, that's the way it is, whether or not you believe it's possible or not. Okay, good lesson for them and a good one for us too. We study the men and women of the Bible, Old Testament or New Testament. We have to remember that unless they're Jesus, okay, that they have their temptations, they have their struggles, they have their problems, and they do falter, okay. And just because one falters and falls down and laughs and says something, don't immediately write off and say, well, I'm done for forever and I quit. You got to go past that, acknowledge your mistake, and go on. Yes or no? No, I think you're right.
But the way that he interacts with them is completely different, though, is the element. Is how Gideon interacts with God. If you look at how, I forget Samson's name.
Manoah and his wife, yeah.
How they interact with God. It is nothing like this. It is with fear and trembling. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I think this can almost act as a precursor for how he interacts with God today. It's much more of a personal relationship.
Okay.
Where you're thought out. That's the thing that's
dead. Not irreverent, but also not so far separated that there's no hope of ever being fellowship. That's a good point. Yeah, because that a great price was paid so that could be taken away. Okay, now I always caution against not treating the Lord as the Lord, but at the same time, that barrier is no longer there. There's a way to have that relationship with God and to have that communion. That's an excellent point. And he starts with them being strangers. And one thing that stands out to me, the Lord, throughout the law, he keeps making this same point. How are you supposed to treat strangers? I mean, it's like every 10 verses in the old law. How are you supposed to treat strangers? Are you allowed to mistreat them? No. Are you allowed to capture them, sell them, kill them, whatever? No. You're not allowed to treat them any day. You treat them like one of your own. Someone that's within your borders, you treat as one of your own. Okay. Israel would need to learn something that Abraham demonstrates here. You treat people the right way, no matter where they're from, no matter what their circumstances, no matter who they are. Three men show up, and Abraham doesn't ask for the riot list of who do you know and why are you here, and the laundry list of all these different questions. He just starts preparing food. Please sit down so I can serve you. He instantly calls these people his servant. Abraham's a rich man. He's got flocks and herds and money and all these sorts of things. And yet when three strangers show up that he doesn't know from Adam, he says, don't pass by your servant. And then he finishes verse 5, since you have come to your servant. Now he does eventually grow to know who they are. Okay, but that becomes clear. But how he treats them in the beginning is really, really important. Anything else that Israel can learn from this, and we ought to learn as well? God knows the heart. He knows the mind. And when you start thinking about that, that ought to get your attention real fast. Because it gets my attention, and frankly, it makes me ashamed of myself to think He knows what I'm thinking. He knows what I just looked at. He knows what I heard and didn't, react to. He knows those things. He knows what you try to keep from Him. That should be a wake-up call. Doesn't have to be now, right? For God to promise it, it doesn't have to occur in the next 80 days or 60 days. And this, I think, 25 years, if I remember right? It's from 75 to 100, so a long time he had to wait. Okay. Well, they weren't supposed to be there for 40 years. They were only in the wilderness a few months. And then they get to Canaan in Numbers 13, and they make a big boo-boo, and they have to go circle around in the wilderness for 40 years. To really kill off that generation. That's a bad way of putting it, but that's what happened. Another thing too is just how do we interact with God? The proper relationship to God is Lord. Not buddy, not friend. He will be a friend to us, but he's not, that's not that kind of relationship. The first, we have to understand He's Lord first. He's the authority. When we start regarding ourselves as servants, we're going to be a long way down the right path of interacting with God. Okay? God is not a God who mistreats His servants or does anything of the sort, but we have to understand that relationship's still there. I would certainly never recommend that. We have to always remember who we're dealing with. And we're not dealing with our pal. We're not dealing with even a benevolent family member. We're dealing with the Lord. We're dealing with the God of heaven and earth that created everything. We have to understand that. And maybe not understand Him because that's impossible, but at least recognize there's a certain way you have to go about things. And I think Abraham's example here is instructive for that. I heard a voice.
If you were in Corinth, you might know the judge first. If you're not talking about it, then you would call it Your Honor.
Your Honor. Yeah. Simply because of the role and the position he or she has. Right? You're out of respect for the office, you might say. Okay. Other lessons, other things that Israel ought to take away from this. Those, we've got some wonderful ones so far.
Maybe just in a more universal kind of looking at both this passage and some of the ones that come before, is how God bears very patient with Abraham and Sarah.
Yes.
Because not only do they consistently make mistakes, they consistently make the same mistakes. But regardless, they're given that next chance. Yeah. And certainly this is something that Israel can already see because they also consistently made the same mistakes.
Yes.
And yet, God has given them chance after still going to follow. He's going to be at least certainly up to the point.
It's good that you notice that this is the same mistake again and again and again and again and again. Same thing Israel would do. David would do the same thing in his life. He had a problem, I feel like, with dishonesty and lying. David exhibits that. But God's patience is overwhelming when you start comparing and you look at all of them kind of. Each time he deals with people, he has to put up with us, right? It's something important to know, to see. Yes, sir. Oh, they thought they were zero. Sarah goes. Same. It's the same mistake. It's the same mistake. And the two that did believe actually did make it. They didn't die when they went and circled back through the wilderness. Because and his was for a separate offense, but Moses' offense is not treating the Lord as the Lord, when you think about it. Because when he strikes the rock, he makes this comment, "Shall we bring from you water from the rock?" Don't do that. Don't say "we" when you're talking about God. Don't ever do that. That's bad news. Because at worst, you're bringing him down to your level, and second worst, you're going up to his. Both of them are bad. Treat him as the Lord. Start from there, and then you'll be okay.
Look how Abraham treated those three before he realized that the Lord was
being born. Yep. He didn't know who it was, but yet. Okay, next time, let's look at, well, I guess we have to, 18 and verse 16, when the men set out and they make this journey to Sodom, Abraham's hospitality actually persists beyond the meal. I want you to kind of look at that and notice it when you see it. And then we'll more than likely get that, and then the intercession on Sodom's behalf. Probably won't start chapter 19 next week, but if we can, we will. One last thing as they're coming in.